Welcome to Why Am I Laughing? The podcast.
Hey everyone, and welcome to the podcast. My name is Ben Harris. With me, as always, is my co-host RJ Sines.
New phone, who dis?
We're your in-house comedy gurus who talk about what's funny, why it's funny, and unappreciated Thanksgiving dishes
like giblet whiskey.
That's a good one. How about pumpkin pie pop rocks?
Turkey stuffing.
What? That's already like a classic Thanksgiving dish.
No, it's turkey stuffing made with uncomfortable family silence.
That's Thanksgiving for you. Today, we're going to be talking about one of the funniest sitcoms in our generation's time, Arrested Development. But first, RJ, please take us through what's going on in the world of comedy news.
Yes, comedy news this week. We have some really cool Netflix news. I think just last week, 2 weeks ago, we were talking about Dave Chappelle going to host SNL. Mm-hmm. It was a great episode. If you missed it, go at least watch his opening monologue. He is a legend.
He's still got it.
He's a legend walking among us. And for him to be on SNL for the first time was really cool. And he had a lot of great things to say, especially post-election. Really funny political humor there. But because of the success of him on Saturday Night Live, well, one can correlate. Netflix has ordered 3 comedy specials from Chappelle. I think we talked earlier about Chris Rock getting a pretty hefty paycheck. Mm-hmm. I think $46 million or something. Dave Chappelle, you know, similar quality performer. You know, one of those guys. He could end up getting another.
So these are all going to be change. You know, just live comedy specials. It's not going to be like a show or a series.
No, it's just going to be stand-up, stand-up. All right. So look for that. TV news, HBO just threw out a trailer for Pete Holmes and Judd Apatow's new show called Crashing. It's not going to be out till February 19th, but go check out the trailer. This looks super funny. Pete Holmes, Judd Apatow, some of my favorite funny men right now. And they have put together a show that's centered around Pete Holmes' actual life as a career. I mean, actual life in his stand-up career.
Okay.
He was a New York comic and had a pretty sad divorce with his wife and, like, ended up sleeping on the couches of multiple comedians.
So does he play the title character in this?
Yes, he's the main character. And it basically follows him, like, on the couches of, like, his friend comedians also in real life. So it's like one of those cool blends of fiction reality. I know we really love that stuff on this show, but I'm excited for it. Again, not till February 19th, but even so, check out the trailer.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
Thanks for the news, Rage.
Yeah. This was a easy week for news. Lots of interesting things going on.
And now for the episode about a hilarious sitcom that made history and the podcast who had no choice but to explain why it was funny. It's Arrested Development. How did I do?
That sounded great.
Yes!
You nailed the intro.
Like I just said, we're talking about Arrested Development. In 2002, Ron Howard pitched this idea of a reality-style sitcom show that would parody themes of most handheld multi-camera shows and pair it with incredible comedic writing. Mitch Hurwitz brought this idea of a riches-to-rags story of a family from Southern California. This resulted in 3 excellent seasons on Fox, running from 2003 to 2006. It gained an incredible fan following and created sort of a mixed-reviewed 4th season when it came out on Netflix.
Yeah.
That's AD, everyone.
I love it. I'm on board. But why is it funny?
That's the question that we come here every Monday night to discuss and explain to you, our audience, the people who follow our podcast. Arrested Development is funny because it elaborately stitches together a singular story using this ridiculous and pretentious family of characters. This show was way ahead of its time. It was fast-paced, obsessively specific, and had style like nothing before it. There are more jokes per capita in this show than you can understand just watching it one time. This wacky, zany, self-sabotaging family is so addictive and you keep coming back to them because they're quirky and hilarious. This is Arrested Development.
I love it. This is one of my all-time favorite shows. Much like so many of the things we've talked about on this show, Arrested Development has heavily, heavily influenced my own personal style of comedy and a lot of writers and comedians in our generation, in our bubble. It is one of those weird things that I find either you haven't really heard of it or you love it.
Yeah.
Cult. You don't meet a lot of people that are like, oh yeah, I saw a couple episodes, not that bad. It's a real love it or hate it kind of thing, but also there's not a lot of hate. It's just they just really haven't seen it, I guess.
Right.
It is very unique. And I think, I mean, in our premise, we talk about how fast-paced it is. It's just unmatched as far as, like you said, jokes per minute. There, it's hit after hit after hit, and not necessarily the same style joke.
Yeah.
I mean, we talked about back in episode 4, the different styles of jokes you can have. I mean, you got someone falling down the stairs while saying a verbal pun that relates back to another episode where a character said the exact same thing in a completely different context. So these multiple entendres just hit you at every freaking moment, and you're just side-splitting, laughing your face off.
You're so right. It comes at you from every angle. It's dry, but so fast, and like we said, like, you watch each episode more than once, and you find new things, you find subtle nuances, you find massive jokes that you forgot about that just smack you in the face again.
Right.
Yeah, I feel like it really is that Seinfeld-esque, we're going to take a story and weave it all together into one singular thing using all these characters. Almost amped up a little bit.
Oh, totally. And I mean, just looking at the time frame when it existed, early 2000s, right? This is, in a lot of ways, the postmodern, right? This is, it's a spoof of itself. It's supposed to look like a reality show, you know, much similar to how, you know, the Paris Hilton show or the Kim Kardashian's
Real World,
and Real World, all that Big Brother crap. Kind of how that's shot, and yet it's perfectly scripted. It's all scripted. It's all comedy. It's all satire on the rich and famous and idiotic and stupid. And so a lot of that is just saying, look at these, the way shows have been, and now we're going to do not that and poke fun at everything along the way.
Yeah. Let's take a look at the style of this show, because we talked before in our Office podcast about The Office doing the mockumentary style, kind of as we know it for the first time. But this was before it, and it is a mockumentary.
That's true.
But not necessarily same style mockumentary.
Well, I guess you could think of it as there's mockumentary in the sense that the documentary can be like a first-person narrative. Like, the camera is its own character, like, telling the story. And that's what we talked about on The Office episode. The camera kind of guides the narration. But the way that the camera, even though it is shot like handheld, which is a documentary style, it's not necessarily, like, it doesn't cut to Michael on a backdrop. He's like, well, I had a bad day at work. Bah, bah, bah.
Right, exactly. So there's not, no talking heads. You don't get an interview with, you know, Michael Bluth in the middle of the show. It's all happening. And you have a narrator speaking over it. You don't get that in The Office. You don't get the sense that that you're invited into this. You're kind of just peering.
And that's something that Jason Bateman had commented on, saying the show is like the Royal Tenenbaums shot like Cops, which is another two popular shows or items in media at the time. You know, Cops, you didn't have a lot of talking heads.
Right. I think of that as like, it's raw. It's all happening right in front of you. They're chasing down this thing right now, just as much as they're driving down to Mexico to go find their dad that escaped from prison.
Right.
Like, it's not necessarily going to take you aside and give an interview about it, like a more like Super Size Me where this guy's talking to the camera. It's all just happening. It's raw.
Exactly. Arrested Development said, all right, let's take the Seinfeld formula and crank it up to 11.
Yeah.
Let's triple the cast of characters. you know, let's quadruple the plot lines and let's make more jokes every second and ditch the laugh track, because the laugh track just sucks up time on our show.
Yeah.
And it's so true. Just how many times have you watched this show and you're laughing and you miss five lines because they just keep going? Sometimes there's good pauses, right, in a joke, and they'll say a joke, it's a little weird pause or musical break or whatever. But, you know, half the time you're just doubling over. You have to pause it and rewind to watch whatever they said next.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the style can be accredited to the writing of the show. Like, there is no missed opportunity in this show.
None.
They like make fun of themselves as much as they're making fun of everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
And like, yeah, like it's so quick, so witty. Like, there's a lot of word play. One of my favorite kind of things that they always go back to is in the beginning of the show, there'll be a word or phrase that is said, and that phrase, almost like in Seinfeld, how the plot gets weaved in and out of a common theme.
Mm-hmm.
They will literally just say that phrase, you know, either the same character says it in 10 different situations and it has 10 different meanings,
mm-hmm.
or 10 different characters all say that thing.
Mm-hmm.
They weave it together in, even these characters are coming back to the same thoughts and ideas and saying the same things.
Totally.
And it's so funny.
We have the protagonist, Michael, who's left to pick up the pieces of the lack of lessons learned time after time. And he's just getting kicked, trying to make this all happen. But you're saying, you know, this show doesn't take any opportunity for granted. Everything is just shoved in there perfectly. And everything in this show is scripted to the slightest hand gesture. Everything. They'll do cut shots where you see in the background a blue handprint from Tobias, like three episodes prior,
right,
when he was trying to cover himself in blue paint for the Blue Man Group. Or, you know, they'll have the corn baller still in the kitchen, you know, from when they burned themselves last episode. Or the Job, the magician illusionist, who always has, you know, tricks always on him. Sometimes accidentally has the penny shooter in his sleeve and it just goes off or something. Like, all these little bits that are so intricately and almost to like an OCD level perfectly placed all over. And I love that. It's endless Easter eggs.
Yeah. And man, just so weaved together perfectly.
Mm-hmm. And Arrested Development does these things, especially through narration, which Ron Howard, who helped create the show,
that's true,
is the narrator, and he'll say things like, Job, out of an act of defiance, attempted to throw the letter into the ocean. And it shows Job throwing a letter into the ocean, but failing miserably. Like, after he failed miserably, he later retired back to the home. Like, the narrator isn't necessarily on the team of the family.
Right. It's totally honest. Never does he take a side. He's just, even sometimes telling you what the characters are actually thinking, even if they're not saying it. They'll say, I totally got this. And then it'll be like,
he did not.
Yeah. And even that, like, they use that to their advantage to create more jokes per capita.
Exactly.
They create this universe that they kind of cling to and call back on, you know. Obviously the company is a major player in the show, but they keep calling back to, you know, old characters, old situations,
business ventures.
Yeah.
All this stuff, family history. Yeah, the flashbacks are also part of the cutaway gags in that. So not only will they say, like, meanwhile, and they'll cut to Job trying to throw something in the ocean just for like 5 seconds, they'll also say, but back in 1995, George Sr. made a poor investment. And it shows like almost a whole 3-minute scene on the corn baller or whatever with Richard Simmons. I forgot that was him. And so these flashbacks help tell a bigger picture to this family and provide more context for all these jokes that go into why they are the way they are, which is very cleverly placed, like we said. you know, you explain more about a character in a few, like if you have one season, you end up explaining like 3 or 4 seasons of history just because you can do these flashbacks.
Yeah. And I think it's so interesting. This show is based in reality esque, mm-hmm. you know, we're in Southern California, even the, you know, times where we get a cutaway, you know, the narrator will say, the Bluth family was not having a good appearance on local news. And it cuts to a local news caster who we know from living in Southern California. He's the guy. Like, he does our news. Like, it's not just an actor that they hired.
Right.
It's based... They are in Southern California. They go to real places. They go to Santa Ana.
Balboa. Yeah. Yeah, all real locations. If you're an Orange County native, you can easily watch this show and say, I think I've been in that area of Balboa, or I've been in this part of the city in Tustin or whatever, Irvine or Orange.
But then at the same time, like reality, Carl Weathers is Carl Weathers, but Martin Short isn't Martin Short. You know, no. they have this incredible list of cameos that they have, but some of them are playing themselves. Andy Richter gets to play himself, but he also gets to play
his three other brothers.
His three other brothers that don't exist in real life.
Yeah. So, and I think I was just going to say that as the perfect example of where they fit on the radar of fiction and reality. It's a yes and. It's a yes, this is reality, but also there's things that don't exist here to make it fictional, which I love. And also, kind of along with that, they make their own story kind of fictional. Not just the universe fictional, but their own story. At the end of every episode, they say, on the next Arrested Development, Job receives a call from the Blue Man Group. But unfortunately, he can't hear it. It's the year that he gets air horned in his ear. Yeah. He says, I got blown. And Michael's like, there's got to be a better way you can say that. I can't hear you. I understand.
Oh my gosh.
But that isn't what happens next on the preceding episode, right?
Yeah, I mean, they use that to their advantage. That's part of their style, is we're just going to, you know, wink at the audience / trick the audience, you know, by saying this is what's going to happen, like a normal show would do the next Arrested Development. And then whatever's happening is just crazy. It's not what's going to happen next. The next episode you watch, it's like this pick up from a totally different place.
Totally different. And yet, so many times, there's callbacks to previous episodes where they don't even use the flashback, right? We talk about how well they use the flashbacks and stuff. They'll say things, especially their classic one-liners. So many of the characters have one-liners. One of the best one-liners that they have is Job saying, I've made a huge mistake. He says that so much.
I want the respect of your son. I've made a huge mistake.
even to the point where there's, like, in later season 2, Michael even will say, I've made a huge mistake.
Yeah.
And it's double funny because that's not his catchphrase, but it's because in that scene, I mean, in that episode specifically, I think he was pursuing kind of a plot line that normally Job does, like trying to win over a woman or something, and he just does, you know, fails miserably. I made a huge mistake. And even, you know, and later on, like, tricking their own one-liners, Job saying, I never admit to making a mistake. But it's like he does it all the time. And I mean, gosh, riddled with cameos.
Yeah. There's so many amazing ones. You have Henry Winkler on the show, like, as a recurring, he's the lawyer, he's Barry Zuckerkorn.
So good.
That's such a good name.
He's just like kind of a loony lawyer.
Yeah.
One of the best things he says, like, right off the bat is, and he might not even, he says it later, but it says a couple times through, like, George Sr., others, like, a husband and wife can't be arrested for the same crime. He's like, Dad, that's not true. I gotta fire my lawyer.
Yeah, he's so skeezy and, like, unprepared. Like, he loses the will.
Yeah.
And kind of just falls over himself. But yet, he's there and people trust him. But I just love that, man, they got Henry Winkler. And then when he gets replaced with Scott Baio.
Blah, blah, blah.
Which is, like, a nice nod to Happy Days. Like, come on. Yeah,
totally. And his name, Bob Blah Blah. And then it's like, it sounds like blah, blah, blah. And then he gets a law blog, L-A-W-B-L-O-G. And it's blah, 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 blah.
Oh my gosh. And that goes to the style. Just so much wordplay.
Totally.
Even in someone's name. Come
just,
on.
Just
that's,
a name.
That's genius writing. You can't, that's not easy.
Oh yeah.
Come up with someone's name that is also wordplay and sounds like blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. you got Carl Weathers, Martin Short. Gosh, Julie Louis-Dreyfus in one of the best cameos as the blind lawyer. Oh my god.
Who's not actually blind.
So there's this whole sequence where Michael's like breaking into her house and she's...
No.
Yeah.
Is it Michael? I thought it was... I think Michael does things around her, but Tobias breaks into the house.
Right, right.
He's like a cat. He's like rolling around and like...
And she's like trying to pretend that she's blind while like trying to like bump into him. And he's just like just quick enough. It's so good. So we kind of touch on some of these little characters and we can come back to more of them. But I really want to get into the meat of this episode, which we've premised with the main characters and how they tie all this style, all this wordplay, all this ridiculousness together. And what this means for the show.
Yeah, I mean, the intro kind of says it very perfectly. And now the story of a wealthy family who lost everything and the one son who had no choice but to keep them all together. This is
Arrested Development.
Well, yeah.
Oh, I thought you were going to say
Sorry, no. This is a singular family character.
Yeah.
They all have very similar attributes. But each one of them kind of peels off. They're all selfish.
Yeah.
They're all selfish in different ways. Yeah. You know, some of them are just overtly selfish.
Yeah.
Some of them are greedy selfish. Some of them are selfish in their pride. Like, we'll start with our main protagonist, Michael, the son who has no choice but to keep them all together. He takes pride in the fact that he is the saving grace. He's the only competent one out of all of this idiot family.
And it's hard too because you relate to him as a main character.
Right.
Everyone in his family is an idiot. Mm-hmm. Chauvinistic, overblown.
Just like real life.
Stupid. Yeah. And he's going, is nobody else seeing this?
Right.
Do I really have to save you all again? And it goes to his head in a couple episodes where he'll even say something like, well, sorry, I always have to save you because you guys suck or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that's an insight to, you're right, the pride he has.
And most of the time it comes back to bite him. You know, he thinks, oh, you know, I did a great job. I'm going to, you know, let Job be president so I can kind of take a back seat. But then all of a sudden now Job has all the power and he like latches onto that and he can't make any decisions. I just watched that one. He's like, he keeps saying...
You're going to look at the guy with the $5,000 suit? Come on!
That one?
No. The one where he says, he's quoted in the newspaper by saying, Job is the president. And then Michael says, and I'm fine with that. And and throughout the entire episode, he has to keep saying, and I'm fine with that. Like, Job like comes into the meeting and brings in... He says, well, if you had a business model, and he brings in a model, and he goes, this is my business model. Solid as a rock. So he then now, because he has a business model, gets to like decide this thing that ends up hurting Michael. And he's like, well, I'm fine with that. Like he keeps coming back to this hurting him. Yeah. His own words are coming back to bite him. Oh, I'm fine with that.
And even just how Michael is strained over and over again. That he kind of is the center of the family in a lot of ways and what keeps us relating to the show. I try to think about a show without Michael because he's obviously not the funniest of characters. The show would be funny without him, but he has a lot of dry sarcasm, very Chandler Bing kind of comedy.
Yeah.
Kind of looks like him too. And
no,
and the delivery and the timing and the place that he's at, he provides a great place for us, the viewer, to say, oh, wow, from your perspective, this is hilarious, but it sucks for you. He's a real Charlie Brown sad sack kind of a guy.
Yeah, sure.
Oh, I love that.
And his son isn't much better.
Yeah. George Michael, not the famous singer. he's clueless. He kind of like his dad tries to make everyone happy, even going against the wishes of his dad. I think of the episode where he tries to get weed for Buster, who's trying to give that weed for Lucille too, to help her vertigo.
Yeah.
But the only way that George Michael can get the weed is going
to Job.
And Michael finds out that Job is going to give him weed, so he has Job hire some police officers who are actually hot cops, aka stripper policemen, to like, you know, stage a prank or teach him a lesson, kind of a thing. But so George Michael goes out of his way to you know, make him make his own, be his own man, and prove that he's not like everyone else in his family. And also, he's helplessly and confusedly in love with his cousin, maybe.
Yeah, and just like his dad, his efforts always are unsuccessful and come back to bite him. He you know, is like attracted to his cousin and wants to be dating her, but then the second he chooses to date someone else, all of a sudden there's this great opportunity for that to happen, and he's like, "What? No." Oh my gosh, like, dun, 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 yeah, and then he's sad. I love that they use the sad music.
Oh my gosh, I feel like I even touched on this. I wish I would have brought this up in style. The beautiful use of music incorporated.
Yeah.
You know, from so many things, especially George Michael. Every time he's like, there's an awkward like moment with him and maybe, it's, I think it's Leroy Elvis. I can't remember the guy's name, but it's the, hey, what you trying to say to me?
Yeah.
It's like some weird, like, sexy song.
My favorite is the reoccurring joke that Buster is actually George Sr.'s twin brother's son. What's the brother's name?
Oscar.
Oscar, yeah. Oscar is his uncle.
Mm-hmm.
But they keep making jokes like, oh, yeah, we're celebrating your dad's birthday, which is coincidentally my birthday.
Dun, dun, dun,
and
dun.
Yeah, that music comes in that's like, dun, dun, dun. And then Buster just never gets it. He's like, yeah, because you're my dad's twin brother.
Like the Lifetime original classic, that kind of music.
Yeah.
They
use music so well.
Yeah, music so well, especially with George Michael. They play the Vince Guaraldi Christmas Time Is Here, which is amazing because Christmas Time Is Here is kind of a gloomy Charlie Brown type song, but you have it on the backdrop of the Peanuts gang, so it's not that sad. But put it to like a sad George Michael walking hunched over, doing that walk. They also do that with Tobias. It's like,
well, they do it with a lot of characters.
That's true.
But like they're so in their own style. They're so true to themselves. They recognize it. And there's one where George Michael's hanging his head and walking by, and there's a big red doghouse with a
beagle
sleeping
on top.
Dog on top. Like they're nodding in so many different ways to what they're doing.
Exactly. Going to talk about his cousin, maybe. Confident, smart, gets what she wants, tough, funny cousin. George Michael and maybe have this kind of like cool dynamic duo comedy that happens in the show where it's like them against like their family, and it's kind of like almost like the Parent Trap kind of theme that they have in their head, like, well, if we do this, like, we can get our family closer together, or we can prove that mom and dad are idiots. And George Michael's always like, oh yeah, that'll work, I'm sure that's a really good idea. And maybe he's like, just like, shut up and do it, whatever.
Yeah, maybe is a lot more independent and confident, and George Michael falls back onto, I just want to do whatever makes anyone happy, or, you know, make sure that I do what my dad says.
Exactly.
Where maybe is really trying to rebel. And I feel like, weirdly enough, she's probably the most successful character. She runs a, you know, a movie production studio for a while.
For a time, yeah.
Yeah, and like her things end up working out where she can just lie her way through being way older than she is, where everyone else, any effort that they give just falls. And I feel like the closer you are to this family, the more likely that you're
going
to implode. Whatever your situation is, it's not going to work out.
Totally. Speaking of situations that just don't work out, George Oscar Bluth, aka Job, That's G-O, yeah, G-O-B. Looks like gob. So many good gob jokes. Job is the firstborn of the Bluth family, so he's older than Michael. He's not a magician. He's an illusionist, and he'll have you know that every single time he points it out. I don't do tricks. I do illusions, Michael. Tricks are what a whore does for money. He's always trying to win his father's approval. He can't hold a J-O-B job. he's terrible to women. He's completely insensitive. Job, you don't even remember her name. Crindy. No. Let me say Saul Zinsman. You're just reading names off a paper. That's not her name. Like,
I feel like this, I mean, probably Michael is the only exception, but Job, along with a lot of other family members, just falls into just the laziness. Like, they want to get what they want, but they want to go by it by the laziest way possible. They want this company that, like, what does even the company do?
It's make a real estate company.
Okay. But this company that has just paid them their whole lives, they just want that to magically give them the money so they can fund whatever they're doing. Like, even so much so that Job doesn't even walk a lot of times. Like, he has a Segway,
yeah,
and he just segues around. Like, they want to go about it by just the laziest means possible. And that always, you know, falls flat on their face.
I need a favor. I need to ask you a favor. He's always asking favors of people.
I love that every time he does any type of magic trick, it cuts to the final countdown.
Yeah, final countdown is his music. He's got like a knife in his mouth, and
which,
like,
is so perfect. Cards. It's so cheesy, magician, illusionist. Like,
he's like very, like, strangely, like, metrosexual magician. is very bizarre, and he can't even do that right. He gets kicked out of.
I think of the time where he wants to. They think that George Sr. died, so he, at his father's wake, wants to be buried alive. And he gets Buster to help him out, but Buster doesn't know that George Sr. is dead. He thinks it's a birthday party. And so he, like, is helping him with this trick where there's a coffin with a trapdoor, and he's like, all right, and now I will be buried at my father's wake. And Buster's like, what? Dad's dead? What? And he like, falls down the mountain, and then Job falls out of the trapdoor. The coffin falls on top of him, and they bury him. Just everything falls apart in this family. Nothing is successful.
Yeah, and along the same lines of no one being successful, Lindsay, the pretentious green thumb of the family, who always tries to rebel against the way her mom got her success with the Bluth Company, she still wants to be rich, but she tries to do it in weird ways, kind of like the way Joe pursues magic. She tries in, like, weird medical supplements, or like saving the environment, or protesting, or trying to be famous. She's got crazy attention seeking behavior.
She's really good at the rich entitled character, where she wants her job to be like philanthropy. Like, that should pay me money, right? Like,
right.
She's just so backwards thinking in terms of work. Like, exactly. She just doesn't do work.
Yeah. And same way, doesn't do any work. Buster is literally still at home with mom. He can't do anything.
Yeah.
He tries to go to army and comes back just doing a crane game.
Yeah. Most of his actions are totally spite driven towards Lucille. I mean, really.
One or two.
Oh, or the loose. Seal.
Dun dun dun.
Like, his whole actions is just, he's helplessly dependent on his mother, and he hates that, and he's trying to get away with that, but he can't do anything without her.
Yeah.
So he's a mess.
There's a great episode with Buster's running away from home, and he's spending more time with Michael, and it's Michael, Job, Lindsay, and Buster. They're all kind of hanging out at the house. And they're like, oh, yeah, mom's such a pushover. Oh, yeah, mom. They're all kind of like saying something about mom. And Buster's like, oh, me. Look at me. I'm mom. I get off on being withholding. And they're like, oh, Buster, you got some beef with mom. Nice. He's like, yeah. And weep, 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 weep. and he's just like cussing like crazy. They bleep out all his cusses, and it just like is showing like Job and Michael and Lindsay like wide eyed, like, oh no, that's so good. But yeah, Buster's like almost disabled. He loses his hand at one point. He's hyper dependent, unsure of himself, and incredibly insecure all the time. Just, I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just so confused.
He tries to get away from his mom by joining the army, but then that actually starts working. He's actually going to join the army because he doesn't realize that the army actually needs people. Now he's scared because he doesn't want to do that. He can't do that. He's dependent. So he just says, I'm going to run away to Mexico. I know my brother's going to Mexico, so I'm just going to jump in the trunk.
But he doesn't have his glasses.
He doesn't have his glasses, and he falls asleep in the trunk. And when he wakes up, they've just dropped the maid off at her house. So he gets off in Santa Ana and thinks that he's in Mexico.
So he goes. He can't see anything. And he crawls under a trampoline in the front yard. And he's like, shield me from the hot Mexican sun. And especially if you live in Orange County, you know that a vast majority of Santa Ana is a highly Latino populated
Hispanic
community.
Yeah.
And that is, it's so, so funny.
It's so good.
To have this character who can't really see, think he's in Mexico.
And even more specific than that, he only makes it as far as the maid's house. So yeah. Then he's like all gang-ho that he's in Mexico. He's like, oh, this is great.
I'm
never going back.
Now.
Yeah. And he's like, let's go to work. So he's like sitting in the back of this truck, and then he gets out and he's like washing dishes and stuff, but he has to take the dish up, and he realizes that he walks up into his own house to bring the food to his mom. And he's like, what? Why are you in Mexico? And he's like, well, I thought you were in Mexico. So ridiculous.
Ugh. He is so funny. But Buster just kills me. His lines, I'm going to arm mother.
Yeah. He's definitely the uniquest sounding character. We also have Lucille, who is
the matriarch.
Yeah. His enemy, but also everyone's enemy in this whole family. She just is overbearing. And I mean, she's really the root of everyone's kind of selfish ways. Like, they all have depended on the money because they've seen her do that.
Yeah.
And that's what she does. She's just this alcoholic, judgmental, overbearing, you know, role.
She's the perfect like Newport Beach like snob. Some of you have seen these women portrayed on television. They actually exist.
Yeah.
More mimosa, please. Like these kind of women who like get their hair like cemented on top of their heads, and Lucille is just so catty. Oh, I think right now she's my favorite character.
Really?
It's changed a lot over the years, but
that's
right
so
now,
funny.
For the last like 5 years, she's my favorite character. And one of my favorite lines, which I will say any time of the week, is, I'd rather be dead in California than alive in Arizona.
Take that, Arizona.
That. And if that's an attempt at a veiled criticism towards me, I won't hear it and I won't respond to it.
Oh my gosh, she's so spiteful.
Yeah.
Like everything that she does is just like to get revenge.
She just tries to knock her kids down a peg every
yeah.
single time. And even sometimes her own husband, George Sr., who this whole show, Arrested Development, is about him being arrested, incarcerated, in multiple different ways, whether it's in jail or the attic or whatever.
Yeah.
But he's, a crooked businessman. He often cons his own family, trying to teach them lessons. And that's why you always leave a note. Like,
yeah.
So many stupid things like that. But the weirdest thing is how he'll pit his children against them. So the parent dynamic is just like trying to raise wolves
yeah.
that just go crazy over each other. And George Sr., who is played by Jeffrey Tambor, does such an amazing job.
Yeah.
He also plays his twin brother, Oscar,
yeah.
which is also Jeffrey Tambor.
Yeah.
And it's just amazing.
It's classic. And that's the characters we got.
Yeah,
And, Tobias.
Oh my gosh, how could you forget?
How could we forget?
Tobias Funke.
Oh my gosh.
The bald, blue, mustached, never nude.
That you went to a Halloween party as.
I did. That's my favorite costume I've ever, ever dressed up as.
That's the most committed that you...
My skin felt uncomfortable. I still can remember how I felt. I've never felt that way in my entire life. If you want to know what it's like to suffocate, aside from covering your mouth, you put, like, real paint all over your pores. Your skin is like, what is going on? And you don't realize how much your skin needs to breathe.
Who won the costume contest at the Halloween party?
I think our friend who went as Lieutenant Dan.
No, I did.
You did?
Yes.
What were you?
Me and my wife went as... I don't even remember, which is how sad, because your costume was way better, and I can't believe I won.
Yeah.
I went as... Oh, that's what it was. It was Ron Swanson and Amy Poehler.
Yeah, whatever. A real hard costume. Slap on a fake mustache and get some slacks.
I just remember being so happy that you put in the most effort out of anyone and didn't win.
I got the memory.
Yeah, you do.
So.
And I don't even remember I had a mustache.
And a bib.
Oh, yeah.
Boo.
Yeah, that was good.
But Tobias, so funny. One of the funniest characters. He's clueless, always trying to just be a good actor. Accidentally makes sexual innuendos like at every corner.
Completely clueless. Doesn't realize what he's saying, what he's doing. He's hopeless. Like, they, in a weird situation, they decide that they're going to have an open marriage and date other people. And he doesn't even try. He just paints himself blue and hides.
Yeah.
To go watch Lindsay fail.
Yeah. He's just got it all backwards, and so many bad things happen to him. And that's the funny thing. It's the bad things that happen to him are mostly missed opportunities.
Yeah. Or ending up in the hospital.
Yeah. Or miscommunications. He goes in for an interview and is like, all right, Mr. Funke, let's go. He's like, there's a fire sale. It's like, no, you missed it. Exactly.
That beat is so good.
We could go back and forth quoting the show.
The attempts always
fail. All day.
Yeah.
All day. There's so much in here that we'll just have to come back and do like a versus episode. Like, who's got the better one-liners? Arrested Development or Community?
Yeah, right.
Or The Office or Third Show that I can't think
against,
of.
It could go up against a lot of good quotable shows.
It's well received, and a lot of people think it's one of the best comedies of all time. So many different.
But here's the thing. We kind of touched on it a little in the intro. The fourth season wasn't really received as well as the original three seasons, right?
Right.
So what was going on there? Why did it fall off a little bit? Why wasn't it funny?
And it's hard to say, because they did get technically they got the entire cast back for the show. But I would say it fell flat in a lot of the ways that we have said it succeeded originally in the first three seasons. The cast could all be together in the same room, right, for multiple scenes at a time in the first three seasons. And a lot of their plots and dialogues could intertwine together. In season four, the cast actually had problems with scheduling. So they could only really dedicate an episode to one character at a time.
There's only one
scene in the whole season where all the characters are in the room together. And there's not that many. Like, sometimes you get more than one, like George Senior and Job, or Michael and George Michael. Like, little scenes here and there, just with one or two, but never the three people in a car at the same time, or all four in a room having a conversation, or having a singing party, or getting stuck in a banana, or something like that.
Well, it is true. In 2003, in the beginnings of the show, those names aren't as big as they were when they filmed the fourth season.
I know.
So they had more on their plate probably at that time.
And in case you haven't known who these people are, Jason Bateman, Will Arnett,
Jeffrey Tambor,
huge names.
Here's my thing. Here's what I think for season four. I say they hangover two'd it. I think they said, here's what worked. Let's just do it again. You know, they tried. There was a Tobias joke that fell flat where, like, in the first couple seasons he did, he's a therapist and a analysis.
Yeah.
And he calls himself
an analrapist.
And then they try it again in fourth season in some weird way. He has a license plate made.
It just isn't.
And yeah. It's like, okay, that was funny. We did that joke already. I think they had moments like that where it's like, okay, it was kind of lazy writing.
Well, and in that same vein, I don't know if they hangover to'd themselves, because if you think about it, like, that's a good formula. What went wrong with the formula, in my mind, is the comedy, right? They did a creatively woven plot, lots of the characters there, but the jokes per minute that just weren't there, which just made it so much more of a tragedy.
Yeah. You are a self-proclaimed big fan of Arrested Development. Do you think the added season 4 tarnishes its good name?
I would almost equate that to the season finale of Seinfeld. Does that tarnish its good name?
No.
Exactly. I don't think it tarnishes it.
I was going to agree. I think you think of Arrested Development, you go to those original seasons, and it's gold.
Yeah.
It doesn't hurt that they tried again and didn't work.
And again, Mitch Hurwitz even said, I would do a fifth season only if I could have the full schedule of
the cast,
which would require a lot of money. But you know who's got those big, big bucks?
You and me, buddy.
You and me and our friend Netflix.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
So, who knows? Six seasons in a movie could happen.
Six seasons in a movie. Isn't that Community?
Yeah.
Close. But since you said Community, which you actually didn't, it's time for the show, a very special part, which we like to call...
Ben's Wacky Facts.
Aww.
Wacky. Yeah. It's the theme song. Every time, I get it, man. You obviously don't want to change it, and I don't care. I'm over it. I'm practicing letting it go. This is me acknowledging that you will always make me upset every week.
I forgot. Wacky Facts is the part of the show where I, Ben, say some wacky facts, and RJ rates them the best way he knows how, putting them on the baseball field.
Sport.
You ready?
Yeah.
Here we go. Lucille number 2. She was very hard for the crew to cast originally, so Ron Howard asked his childhood babysitter, Liza Minnelli, if she would do it, and she agreed on the spot.
Wow. You never knew never knew who your babysitter is going to be.
Right?
I guess so. Is that the moral of the story?
I don't think so. I think Liza Minnelli's character is not just a cameo. Yeah. She's a very recurring character. She's a love interest of Buster's.
Yeah.
So I just think it's so interesting that you think all this thought and planning went into it, but it was kind of just like,
huh,
have this connection, and I asked.
Well, I mean, I'm sure if you break down so many of these castings, it's just hop, skip, and a jump. The Kevin Bacon 7 degrees, 6 degrees, or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, you just, everyone's connected, especially in the Hollywood industry.
What has it got to do with Kevin or Bacon?
You've never heard the 6 degrees of seven Bacon, Kevin Bacon? You never heard of that?
The 7 degrees of Kevin Seven.
It's like
six?
Everyone in Hollywood is just a few degrees connected to Kevin Bacon. Everyone. Have you heard that theory? We'll spend a whole episode on it next week on Why Am I Laughing? No, this is a very, very good fact. Very wacky. I would rate this in the analogy of a baseball game wherein the main player is up to bat and the pitcher throws a pitch and he hits it and it's a pop fly and it's going over second base and it's going to the field and wait, Miss Stacy, RJ's former babysitter, is going to catch it. Oh, she misses it. It's a home run for the Cubbies. Cubs win. Cubs win. Cubs win.
Wow, there was so many cameos in that baseball game. Your babysitter, Harry Carey.
And
some
myself.
Other announcer. Yeah. Home run, ladies and gentlemen. You heard it from Harry Carey himself. The next wacky fact is the fact after this sentence. Ron Howard, as the narrator, was accidentally put in that role. He filled in for the pilot episodes, and the producers liked it so much they said, it works, we'll keep him.
Oh, wow.
So he wasn't gonna play that role. He kind of helped create this.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, for the pilot episode, I'll just say it until we find a good narrator. And they were like, no.
And it just fit.
You're in.
It fits so perfectly.
Right?
That's awesome. I know how to rate this. This is a perfect gentleman up to bat, goes to hit the pitch, and the ump goes, strike, and then you hear the announcer, but it wasn't a strike. It was a home run.
Because, it's Ron Howard.
Yeah, and it's Ron Howard just narrating the fact that the ump was wrong. Very wacky.
That's so wacky. It doesn't even make sense how wacky that is. Here's the last wacky fact. Arrested Development was the name of a band at the time when the show came out. The band said, what the heck, we're going to sue. And they did successfully for a large settlement. I couldn't get the hard numbers.
But they wouldn't pick up your phone calls?
No, I tried. But in classic Arrested Development fashion, they spoof it in the episode called Mother Boy XXX. There is, I think, a pageant called Mother Boy.
Yes.
And then Ron Howard goes, not to be confused with Mother Boy, the band. And it plays a clip from it. And it says, they actually sued the pageant. And it's like literally troping what they actually did. It's literally spoofing what actually happened to them.
That's so funny.
Isn't that awesome?
That is wacky. You know what that is?
Put it on the field, brother.
Putting it on the field. That's Jackie Robinson Caruso up to bat. Pitcher goes to throw the pitch, and he hits it, and it's a line drive. It's going. It's going. It's gone. And meanwhile, there's some little boy in a baseball game playing a home run derby on his iPad and watching a real home run happen. I tried to make some kind of meta analogy. It really fell apart there.
It's okay.
Like the snow globe thing. You know, and the kid's like, oh yeah, he's in the snow globe.
He's shaking the snow globe that he's in.
It's something special. Yeah, yeah.
Got it. He's playing the iPhone game that's happening right in front of him.
Yeah, I'm trying to make the Santa Claus 2 kind of analogy. Just forget about it.
The Santa Claus.
Hey, you can't hit a home run every time with wacky facts.
But I just did. Didn't I hit 3?
No, I mean, I didn't.
Okay, cool.
I mean, you can. I definitely can't. The analogies are very difficult on the fly.
And next week on Why Am I Laughing?
RJ comes up with a clever analogy for once. He doesn't.
But you know what that means? It's time for hashtag whale mail of the shweek.
Cha-cha-cha-cha-ching. This week's whale mail reads, gentlemen, I would like to humbly request that you discuss Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Seems like it could be a good overall topic, particularly since Monty Python, in general, has been so influential in comedy. Hope all is well. Randy.
You read that last part wrong. Hope all is well.
Oh, yeah. Wow. I didn't see the exclamation point. Hope all is well. That's all Randy. Caps. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hope all is well, Randy. No, thank you. Everything is well. I wish we could have run the AC, but here in the studio, it really picks up all that whirring. So we're kind of sweaty, but overall, very well.
Very well. Yeah. Hey, thanks, Randy, for writing in. We appreciate your fandom. We appreciate you listening. And we also appreciate the fact that you want us to talk about Monty Python and the Holy Grail, because that is on our list.
Absolutely. That's one of the first shows we talked about doing. And quite honestly, I don't think you guys are ready for it.
I don't think we're ready for it. There is a depth of knowledge, of comedic value in Monty Python and the Holy Grail. I mean, Monty Python as an entity.
It's like the bedrock of all 21st century comedic influence. Yeah. Everyone traces back to Monty Python in one way or another, through sketch comedy, films, visual puns, gags, cutaways, characters, impersonations,
and really
everything.
Their story is super interesting. The way that they came together and got brought into a single entity of writing groups where they had partners and coming together with this sketch comedy show that they like kind of just broke barriers and set precedents. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting. So definitely we have our eye on Monty Python and also Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Yeah, two completely separate episodes. Yeah, I can't wait to do the Monty Python and the Holy Grail episode. Consider it bumped up towards the top of the list, Randy. Thank you very much for your email.
That's our email. But RJ, where can people find us?
You can find us on the iTunes podcast app, Google Play, or Stitcher. You can check out our Twitter page, at WhalePod, our Facebook page, Why Am I Laughing? And again, don't forget to email us at whyamilaughingpod@gmail.com. You can find me at Twitter, at Rodolfo LeBrown. You can find Ben at CrossFitDads3000. But thanks so much for tuning in this week. Thanks to Ben Sound for our theme music. I'm sorry, Ben, what? You laughing at your own Twitter handle?
I find it comical. I did a good job of coming up with my Twitter handle. It makes me laugh.
Yeah, I hope you're really proud of the group of CrossFit dads that you lead every week. They are a collective group of incredible gentlemen.
3,000.
3,000. Well, all the first 2,999 numbers were taken. Yeah.
Once again, thank you, Ben Sound, for our theme musics. We want to encourage you to rate us on iTunes and tell your friends about this show. If you like it, if you don't, tell them anyway. Maybe they'll like it. But you can check back every Why Am I Laughing Wednesday for a new episode, and we'll have something there waiting hot and fresh in your mailbox, ready to be listened to with your golden ears.
Fresh in your Brexits, Governor! It's kind of thinking in the same lines as Mrs. Featherbottom.
Wouldn't you say that's Monty Python rooted?
Oh my gosh. The Cockney accent is only Monty Python.
He's not dead yet!
Yeah, 100%. So that's so good.
But we've always said comedy is all about
Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Timing.
Oh man, I was thinking about Franklin.
We didn't talk about Franklin?
I don't want no party in China's club! You freak, man! Timing.